From Michigan Radio, this is Stateside. I'm April Baer. Today, misinformation about COVID-19 vaccines and fertility has made some people hesitant to get a shot.
There is no data to suggest that it causes infertility, that it increases your risk for miscarriages.
We'll talk with a doctor about how the rumors started and what she's telling her patients. Then, in a year of social distance, one college lecturer connects to her students through letters.
There are some students who I feel like I know much more intimately from the things that we have shared this year.
And a Grand Rapids man who once faced felony charges for growing marijuana now runs his own dispensary with a little help from his mom.
Who am I to judge? Who am I to say, no, that's not okay for you? It has completely changed my whole attitude.
Those stories and more coming up. Welcome to Stateside. I'm April Baer. On today's show, we'd like you to meet a mother and son who've become unlikely business partners in a new cannabis dispensary in Grand Rapids.
It's just neat watching him mature and move forward in an area that he's so excited about.
But first, we want to tackle a subject that a lot of people have questions about: COVID vaccines and fertility. It's a super hot topic for families and for some young women. Maybe you've seen the rumors flying around, especially on Facebook. Just the suggestion that there might be a link was enough to scare a lot of people into steering clear of vaccination, or at least deciding to wait. Doctors like D'Angela Pitts at Henry Ford Health System have been getting a lot of questions about whether COVID vaccines could affect fertility in women and girls. Dr. Pitts is a maternal fetal medicine specialist. She sees people who are expecting or trying to get pregnant. Dr. Pitts, welcome to Stateside.
Thank you very much for having me.
Do you remember when you first started getting questions about vaccinations from people who are pregnant?
I first started getting questions in December, and then I posted on social media about getting the vaccination, and I got a ton of questions from family and friends.
Yeah. Were a lot of your patients wondering about this?
Yes. This is a question that we get almost every day.
What did people tell you about where they were hearing information that led them to have concerns about their fertility?
Most of the questions stem from social media, such as Facebook and blogs, that they were concerned that if they get the vaccine, that this was a ploy to decrease fertility or kind of control population.
Yeah. Do you know where the myths about the vaccines and fertility even got started?
It comes from a provider who worked in the lab and theoretically believe that the vaccine can cause effects with animals and can decrease that placenta from attaching, thus causing infertility.
Right. So again, this was not somebody who tested that out. This was something.
Exactly.
All right. Yeah. And what is the truth about how the vaccine interacts with the body during the implantation period or during pregnancy?
There is no data to suggest that it causes infertility, that it increases your risk for miscarriages. And there's just no data to indicate that there's a need to delay attempting conception or pregnancy after the vaccination.
Now, I know that I'm not trying to beat this to death, but I think some people might have very specific questions about this. Is that this subject has been investigated and has been proved to be untrue, or is it just that there's no data to suggest at this point?
That's a great question. There is some preliminary data. It is not published just yet. And then a lot of physicians have patients that have gotten the vaccination and have been pregnant.
Yeah, I've seen one medical provider say that this is going to be a pretty key question if we get to the point this fall where younger and younger girls are eligible for emergency authorized vaccinations, that parents will have questions about this. You know, they will want to be reassured that they are not doing anything that would affect their children's future choices for having a family. What would you want them to know about that?
I think that's a great question. And as that parent, I'm happy that you are advocating for your daughter in the in her reproductive role. As of now, there's no evidence to show that it does decrease future fertility. We have had patients get the vaccination and become pregnant, and even those get the vaccination during pregnancy and have a safe delivery. So there's no role to say that it increases miscarriages, birth defects, or even needing someone to seek fertility workup.
It's not hard to see how this conversation has been a little confusing to follow for pregnant people when it comes to the vaccine. There were some organizations, I want to say the World Health Organization, who initially were not recommending that pregnant women get vaccinated unless they were high risk. And it wasn't until just a couple of months ago that Pfizer started allowing pregnant women into their vaccine trials. What did this mean for the people you knew who were either in, I guess, early stages of pregnancy or trying to conceive?
So that was a difficult time. The WHO had put out the statement because initially there were not pregnant women allowed in that clinical trial along with children under the age of 16. And the Society of Maternal Fetal Medicine, American Congress of Obstetrics and Gynecology put out statements saying that we recommend the vaccination in our patient population and in lactating women, just due to we've seen the effects of COVID disease in pregnancy and how that can take an effect with increased risk of stillbirth, preterm birth, admissions to the ICUs, and even in some unfortunate cases, maternal death. Mm.
I imagine that there are still some people who may hear everything that you have to talk to them about and may have done a lot of research and might still just feel like, even though they understand the facts, like they'd just like to see more. Do you worry about their health?
I do worry, but I do understand that when it should be a shared decision making with your provider. So as a provider, as a physician, I should be able to give you the facts and what I believe, and I want you to come to that decision and a sound decision. I don't want to force a vaccination. I want you to be able to make that choice on your own. And in terms of recent data, just recently, the Society of Maternal Fetal Medicine put out a statement that since getting the vaccine, there has been reported 85,000 pregnant women receiving the vaccine. And there was a recent publication that for those that got the vaccine, you can enroll in a V-Safe program. And 3,900 women enrolled in that program from December 14th to February 28th. And at that time, as of now, 827 had uncomplicated pregnancies, completed their pregnancies, and no increased risk of any problems. So we are getting some more data, and the data supports our decision and our recommendation for having women get the vaccination.
The V-Safe program, for folks who may not have heard of it, I think is just a way for people to report how they're doing after their vaccination. So it's not quite the same as a clinical trial, but it has been really useful to keep an eye on what's evolving.
Absolutely. And it's with the CDC, and you get text messages every day for 1 week and then weekly for 1 month. And the text messages include smiley faces, sad faces to see how you are doing. So it's our way to reach out and get more information.
When you are talking to someone who's come in for a visit or someone who you've seen socially and you feel like, you know, maybe they've changed their mind about this, how important is it to have a vaccination ready at hand? I only ask because if we were to, say, have a conversation about a flu shot, it's not uncommon for a nurse to come right in after the doctor leaves and say, okay, roll up your sleeve, let's do this. That's not possible with COVID vaccines quite yet.
I hope that we do get there. It is definitely easier for us to have that conversation in clinic and for someone to come in and administer the vaccine instead of going online, scheduling it or calling and then put on hold for a while. So convenience, hopefully we get there.
Well, I guess the $64,000 question then is that might have some, that may be determined by whether the Johnson & Johnson vaccine is once again cleared for use. Is that a vaccine that you would recommend for your patients?
I would still recommend it for our patients. Yes, it had some side effects with the blood clots. However, we still recommend it for our patients, and Society of Maternal Fetal Medicine had previously recommended. Now we just need to know that there is risk with the blood clots.
I've got to believe that this round of the COVID pandemic is not the first time as a healthcare provider that you've had to confront some misinformation that patients have heard either through social media or friends or family. I mean, we all do it. I can't remember how many times I've said, hey, you know what I've heard today? And sometimes those things that we hear in passing are true and sometimes they're not. How do you approach that conversation with patients about the research that they're doing?
I think the first thing is to, as a provider, is to listen and to understand the questions that they have and try to dispel those myths, but to bring out the evidence and the numbers and give anecdotal reasons and examples of patients and why that myth is untrue. I think we just have to have an open conversation with our patients and bring it up. I also think we have to take this conversation outside of the hospital, into our communities, into our churches, and also on social media as well.
Do you know any folks who've become pregnant since getting a vaccine dose?
Yes, I do. So as a high-risk doctor, we do a lot of ultrasounds. So I see these patients for their ultrasounds, for their anatomy scan. They're doing great, and there's no increase of birth defects in this patient population.
Dr. Pitts, it's a real pleasure talking to you. Thank you for taking a few minutes with us about this.
Thank you.
Dr. D'Angela Pitts is a maternal fetal medicine specialist with Henry Ford Health System. We'll post a link to a Henry Ford fact sheet that Dr. Pitts passed along on today's show page. Find it at michiganradio.org. Coming up, this has been such a strange and difficult year to be a teacher. One University of Michigan lecturer has been using letters to connect with her students outside the Zoom screen.
It felt like there was so much going on that to not take a minute every week to just recognize the context that we were swimming in, it made it feel even more unreal.
We'll meet her in just a moment. Stay with us. You're with Stateside. I'm April Baer. The end of the academic year is, like so many other things, a pile of mixed feelings. Stressed out students and instructors all over are in the final stretch and looking back on this phase of pandemic learning. Margot Finn wrapped up the year in a letter to her students. Finn is a lecturer in the University of Michigan's Applied Liberal Arts program. Her letter was republished publicly by the union that represents non-tenure-track faculty at U of M. We wanted to talk to her about it. Margot Finn, welcome to Stateside.
Thanks for having me.
So you've been writing letters to your students all throughout the term, yes?
Yeah, it started slightly before the semester, actually, because I just wanted to let people know that there were no textbooks to buy because I was using Perusall, this program where they were going to annotate readings online. So just to, you know, reassure people that if they were worried that they weren't seeing textbooks to buy, that that's correct. No textbooks. And, you know, just a few other logistical things. And then a week later, the Graduate Student Union went on strike. And so I wrote another letter to kind of be like, oh, what, you know, what does this mean and what's going on? So I didn't intend to, but it ended up being, it felt like essential to kind of recognize what was going on our campus and in the world and then what that was going to mean for the class.
Well, God love you. I somehow thought that stay-at-home orders during the pandemic would mean time to write all the letters, and I have written maybe two the whole time. It seems like this form of communication has really picked up some steam for you, though, through the course of the term.
Yeah. I really am a letter writer. It's that is a practice that I engage in a lot. Even in some of my private journaling, I'll take an epistolary form, like I'm writing a letter to somebody, even though it's not a letter that will ever get sent. So I guess that's just something I do a lot of. But the weekly letters to my students, I mean, I joked on my Facebook page a lot that they were more for myself sometimes. I mean, it's been such a year, right? Like it was like, you know, for the graduate students are on strike, and then everything in the lead up to the election, and then the election itself, and the aftermath, you know, and after the summer that we had last year, and in the midst of pandemic, it felt like there was so much going on that to not take a minute every week to just recognize the context that we were swimming in, it made it feel even more unreal, I think.
Right. Your final letter to your students, though, is so beautiful. Will you read a bit of it for us?
Thank you. Yeah, I think from kind of early in the letter, as I was just describing, you know, the semester, I said, some of you I feel like I'm saying goodbye to without ever really getting to say hello properly. And I hope those of you I haven't gotten to connect to personally have gotten at least some of what you wanted to out of the class. Designing an asynchronous class sometimes felt like being a poker dealer who, instead of dealing the usual hand and taking bets and dealing again as needed, instead laid out solitaire hands for everyone at the table and then promptly disappeared into a poof of smoke and gather town sessions where we couldn't even hear each other. Others of you I've gotten to know more intimately than ever, zooming into each other's homes, writing papers among and about family members and roommates, and sometimes sharing anxieties and sickness and loss that we're going through simultaneously alone and as part of a collective cultural experience. As I look back across the weeks we spent together and apart and all that transpired in that time, what glimmers for me in the midst of great darkness is how often I got to see the light of learning switch on for you. Through your videos and quiz responses, your astonishing papers, and our Zoom meetings and email exchanges, I feel I've gotten to know at least some of you as well as I might have in a normal semester. Every one of those moments of getting to learn with you have sustained me.
Wow. Margo, how long have you been teaching?
10 years in this fashion. So I got my PhD here at the University of Michigan in 2011. And then that fall was my first semester as a lecturer. So I had been teaching as a graduate student during my PhD program, but my first semester teaching as a lecturer with my own classes was the fall of 2011. So this is my 10-year anniversary coming up.
At risk of trivializing some of what this year has been like, it almost sounds from what you wrote like you've gotten to know students in more of a way than you ever have before this year.
Yeah, it's been a very strange mix. There are some students who I feel like I know much more intimately from the things that we have shared this year than I have ever gotten to know students before, with the exception of, you know, students that I've worked with very closely over a long period of time, like a student who would do an independent study with me or something. You know, most years I collect maybe 2 to 4 students who I will keep in touch with for a long time, maybe forever, you know, who become friends. And this year, I feel like I collected 4 the first term and was like, wow, that's a little bit more than normal. And I think there are 7 to 10 from this semester that if they don't keep in touch with me, I will feel wounded. Like I will feel a sense of rejection because of the type of things we know about each other's personal lives feel too weird for me to not know what they're doing in 2 years. Like you're going to have to tell me how it works out, right? Like I need to know how the story ends.
Yeah.
That doesn't happen with that many students in a normal year.
When people have been in battle together.
That's exactly right. That's exactly how it feels.
Yeah. Are you the kind of person who had an easy transition to teaching online, or were you one of those folks who found it more difficult to get across what you needed to get across over the impersonal mediums that we have, like Zoom and online documents?
Oh, that is such a good question. I feel like I have struggled, but at the same time, I feel like my classes this semester went really well. I am really pleased with how my classes this particular semester went. Last semester, one of them went pretty well, and one of them I was pretty disappointed and sad about. And then last winter, it was kind of half and half. And I was pleased with how the classes worked out given the circumstances, but frustrated with the limitations of what we could do with the like second half of the semester on Zoom. So it's, I think what I can see is that I have learned and done better. Like I can see the improvement over that time period. I didn't require my students to attend any Zoom sessions either semester, actually. I just couldn't do it. I did last fall, we continued to have our same class schedule. We just did it on Zoom. And I was so allergic to that that I just didn't do it at all this year, couldn't do it. To me, teaching on Zoom felt like a consent violation of my students. Like, they can't walk away from you. And to me, that's just,
oh, yeah, wait. Oh, yes, they can. There's this thing called leave meeting.
Oh, okay, yeah, but it just doesn't feel like you can really walk away in the same way. You don't feel like you have the same freedom, because if you walk away, you're not there. Whereas in a classroom, you know, like, you get to be a person. You get to have your own autonomy over your own body and space, and it just feels like Zoom takes that away in a way that I feel like I don't know if they want to be there. And that is a killer for me in terms of I can't teach to a room of people that I feel like I have coerced into being there.
It is intense, you know, the staring into someone's face for the entire period of a lecture. I hadn't thought about it that way.
It's exhausting. We don't have that kind of eye contact with people in life. Like, that's, it's too much.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Have you received replies from any of your students?
Oh, yeah. The response to the letters actually all semester has been warm, and was part of the reason for continuing it is that, you know, right away, and part of it is because of the chaos of the GEO strike and just everything that was going on in the fall. But I was immediately hearing from students saying, thank you. Thank you for telling us what's going on. Thank you for acknowledging the things that are going on in the world. Thank you for talking about our mental health. Thank you for talking about your mental health and what things you are doing to try to protect and enhance it. Just there was a constant stream of thank you so much. Thank you so much. So I kept doing it in part because I was hearing from students that it was very important to them.
Do you have any students who had such a difficult time this past semester that they may not be graduating when they thought they would?
There were a number of students who withdrew. It was midway through the semester, and I think four students who had been doing the work all along withdrew. It was like I got an email from like the automated email, not an email from the student being like, I'm struggling. And I had a hard time with that because that has never happened to me before, not once. So to have it happen four times in one semester, yeah, I felt powerfully out of touch with my students and just like, again, they'd been doing the work. They'd been writing great quiz responses. They'd been annotating the readings. These were students who I felt like I had kind of gotten to know a little bit. You know, I knew their voice. I knew what they were interested in.
Yeah.
And then just poof, gone. And my feeling is like, oh my God, this semester is going so poorly for you. And I didn't even know, you know, like, you're doing great work for me, but whatever else is going on, it's like, you're in such crisis that you're like, no, I'm giving up on this semester.
Do you have anything you'd like to say to students who were in that situation?
Well, I hope you don't think it's your fault. Whatever happened, you know, I think that sense of like so many people were struggling so much, and I hope it was a like a good crying uncle and taking space that was necessary. And I hope they don't have a sense of failure, I guess is what I would say. I hope that you recognize the insane world historical circumstances we were all trying to function under. And so whatever reason you decided you couldn't finish the classes you hoped to finish this semester, like, good for you for deciding that your survival was more important and choosing yourself, and come back to it when and if you want to. And it's also okay if you decided at that moment to walk away from something that was just really bad for you forever. Like, that's okay too.
Margo, do you know if you're going to be teaching in person or maybe async in the months to come?
So I'm not teaching this spring, this summer. I think I'm teaching in the fall. I plan to. I'm under contract to. And,
right.
And my understanding is that we'll be in person. And my classes are smaller. So I know there's some question marks, I think, over the bigger classes. Because depending on what kinds of distancing people are trying to do inside, like, there might not be space for really big classes. But my classes are all small enough that I think the expectation is that we'd be in the group of classes that will almost certainly meet in person. Then there's still questions over like, but if we're distancing either to 6 feet, or it sounds like maybe we're moving to 3 feet and masking, what does that mean for what kinds of activities and discussions? Like, can I have multiple groups meeting in a classroom with distancing? So I think we're going to be in person, but there's still question marks over what that even looks like.
How do classes next fall feel to you right now? Does that feel like something you're looking forward to?
I think I'm mostly looking forward to it. I have question marks in my mind, but those were like, I want to answer them. I want to know it, all the things that I'm not sure how they're going to be, and I'm not sure if they're going to be bad or good or whatever. I want to know. I'm curious.
Are there things that you've taken away from doing this asynchronous stuff that you think might influence your teaching overall in the future?
Yes. I have like an enumerated list that I'm expanding constantly. But one thing I know that I will do, I've started this year referring to deadlines as best by dates. And I'm just going to keep that. We're just going to do that forever. Because, I mean, that's always basically been the approach, because I'm not going to grade every paper the day it comes in. like, there's never been a circumstance where somebody's been like, you know, I have like a lot of exams this week. Can I have a few extra days? And I've been like, no, that's never happened. It never would happen. So the deadline has never really been a deadline. Why call it that?
Yeah.
You know, like, only the students who know how to advocate for their needs will tell you when they need an extension.
Yeah.
And there is an uneven distribution of that skill in the student population. So the way to have everybody really truly have access to what your official policy is, which is true flexibility, is to say that the policy is true flexibility so that everybody can avail themselves of it.
Margot Finn is a lecturer within applied liberal arts at the University of Michigan. Margot, take care.
You too, thanks.
If you'd like to read a link to Margot's whole letter, we'll post a link on today's show page. Asparagus in your cocktail? I'm as skeptical as you on this one, but let's give the Cheers team a chance to change our minds.
Cheers.
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 Hi, Tammy.
Hi, Lester.
That's Tammy Coxon with Tammy's Tastings. I'm Lester Graham with Michigan Radio, and we're working on another... Oh, I'm not working on it. Tammy's working on another cocktail here. Now, I see you've got a couple of Michigan bottles here. I'm familiar with at least one of them. I have never seen you with that kind of produce before.
Well, it is asparagus season, Lester, and why should we just eat asparagus when we can drink it too?
I love asparagus, but in a drink, I'm thinking maybe in a Bloody Mary is one of those many different additions they do these days, but how do you make a cocktail out of asparagus?
I think you are going to be very pleasantly surprised. So, of course, to make a cocktail from asparagus, you've got to find some way to get the asparagus flavor out of the stalks and into the glass. So first thing I'm going to do is take a couple stalks, chop them into small pieces, then muddle the heck out of them. Every bit of COVID-related frustration I've had in the last year, I put into those asparagus stalks. And now I've got them nice and muddled up, so now I can go ahead and add 1.5 ounces of gin. And I am using the Iron Fish Distillery Michigan Woodland Gin, which I'll tell you more about in a minute. And then 1/2 ounce of akavit from our good friends at Norden Akavit. So a nice double base here. Then 3/4 ounce of ginger syrup and 1/2 ounce of lemon juice.
How do you make ginger syrup?
So chop up some ginger, mix it with sugar and water, just like you'd make simple syrup. Let it simmer on your stove for 5, 10, 15 minutes, depends how much you're making. Put the lid on it and just let it cool.
That's easy enough. So I'm watching you as you're making this and as you're pouring it, and that's a neon green, and I don't recall my asparagus being a neon green like that. That's an amazing color. I love it. I love the way it appears. The only time I've seen anything like this before is you used some arugula in a drink one time, and it was green like that.
It is true. It is very green. You know, whenever you muddle something fresh and green like that, you kind of bust out all the chlorophyll, and that's going to make your drink really pretty.
Well, it is very pretty. And a nice little garnish there with the asparagus stalk. Are we ready to taste this drink?
I'm ready.
Okay, go ahead.
Oh, you're going to make me start?
Yeah.
I already tasted it. I know that it's delicious. I can't wait to see what you think.
Oh, as soon as you lift it to your nose, you can smell the asparagus in it.
I'll warn you, you'll be able to smell the asparagus later, too.
Mm. Oh, so there's a lot going on there. But what it makes me think of is fresh-cut grass, and it's really not a typical kind of cocktail because it's got this kind of edginess to it, and I don't know how to explain it. Perhaps you can tell us what I'm getting from this drink because...
Well, you get a little bit of the sort of sharp notes from the ginger, warming notes from the ginger, which is really nice. The caraway from the Norden Akavit kind of just cuts through there. It's not a lot, just 1/2 ounce in the drink, but it really
Definitely does add this extra
herbal note. I have made this drink just with gin. It's perfectly delicious with just gin, but the Akavit really does elevate it. And then I think you're getting some of this Iron Fish Distillery gin. So this is their Michigan Woodland gin. It's all Michigan botanicals, and they're not using any citrus in here. What they are using is the tips of concolor fir trees, the little sprigs. Mm-hmm. And they say when they distill those, it has a citrusy character to
it.
Yeah. And it's of course, it's also going to be quite piney. And it really is like a walk in the woods. I knew you would want to taste some. So
yeah,
I poured
a
little
Absolutely.
Bit for you there.
Thanks. Appreciate that. because we don't grow lemons here in Michigan, some people have used lemon verbena for their gins.
Lemon balm, but right. This is a total other way of kind of getting at that citrus character without any actual citrus.
It's definitely got some citrus notes. But all congratulations to them for finding a source like that. That's interesting.
And all that great pine, though. Mm-hmm. Like, I really, really like this gin. It's very much what I enjoy in a gin. And I thought that those green woodsy flavors in here would work well with the asparagus. And I'm glad I was right.
Yeah, it turned out wonderfully. What do you call this drink?
It's called the Stock and Trade. It's from a San Francisco bartender named Brian Mean. And I discovered it a few years ago when I was researching supposed aphrodisiacs for a Valentine's Day class. And to my great surprise, discovered asparagus was used in France as an aphrodisiac. Mm. And so that's where I came across this cocktail, and I have loved it ever since.
It is very good. I like it a lot. I know that appearance does only get you so far. It only gets you to the nose, but it is a beautiful looking color and a great presentation, I think.
And we drink with our eyes first. Cheers.
Cheers.
Casey Cornoli's run-ins with law enforcement over marijuana strained his relationship with his mom. But now, she's helping with his dispensary.
Generationally, I grew up not thinking about it the way my son thinks about it. And I have come around to embrace it more.
They'll talk to us about the evolution of their relationship and their relationship with cannabis in a moment. We'll be right back. This is Stateside. I'm April Baer. This weekend is Mother's Day. We wanted to introduce you to one Grand Rapids entrepreneur who says that his business, launched amid the pandemic, would not be what it is without his mom. It's a family operation with multiple generations pitching in. And there's a lot to unpack here about running a new locally owned business during a time of national crisis. And the business is cannabis. Casey Cornoli is the owner of Farmhouse Wellness. That's Farmhouse with a PH. It's a medical and recreational marijuana dispensary in Grand Rapids. Casey, welcome to Stateside.
Thank you so much for having us today.
And also with us is Patty Cornoli, Casey's mom. She is involved with the dispensary too, working on deliveries and other aspects of the business. Patty, it's so nice to meet you. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you very much.
So Farmhouse started out with sales and opened up shop in March of 2020. That was a major month in Michigan. Casey, what was it like starting your business right at the beginning of the pandemic?
It was a challenge. It was a long process to open the provisioning center in Grand Rapids to begin with. And then when we finally did get it open, we absolutely did not anticipate, much like a lot of people probably did not anticipate, the airborne pandemic that would follow through COVID-19. So we were actually open for just a short period of time before the governor enacted or government mandated state lockdown. And that really just changed our business forever and even up until this day. So it was and has been a lot of change since we've opened up, but also a very rewarding process too.
Yeah. When we think about family businesses, we might picture a mom and pop restaurant or, I don't know, a father and son repair shop or mother and daughter accounting service. But a family run local cannabis business. Have you guys ever run across another business like this?
I haven't. I've heard stories that there's perhaps other, other family run cannabis businesses, but maybe more so just from the organizational structure and less on the day-to-day operations. I think it is kind of unique and a little rare to have an owner of the business be there and then be there alongside their mother and father. And that is just another factor that makes Farmhouse Wellness extremely unique in what we do. We are just a little house. It was previously a residential home converted to retail, but it has that home feel, and it also has that family feel, which is really cool.
Patty, the thing that my husband and I always say when this subject comes up, that if we ever had to work together, we'd kill each other. And you're you work with both your husband and your son. Had you had any professional experiences that prepared you for this?
absolutely not. I used to work in surgery. I was a scrub nurse. And if anything, that taught me to be anticipate and be prepared and over-prepared. But no, this is a totally different industry from that.
Yeah. Casey, I read that you came from a background in corporate banking.
Well, they shall remain nameless, but it is true. And I am thankful for that experience. It is part of my past. It's something that I'll never forget, but I do feel like it's something, it's an experience that shaped, who I am today. And again, I'm thankful for what I learned in corporate banking, but I feel that it wasn't a full demonstration of who I am as a person. And so, being in the cannabis industry is just a better match. It's a better alignment with who I am, my characteristics and my traits and my goals in life. So
I believe you also had worked as a caregiver at one point.
Absolutely. I've always been drawn to the cannabis plant. It's something that I was involved in from early adolescence. And then in 2008, they opened the medical marijuana program, which allowed me to be a patient and then also a caregiver. And I've worked with terminally ill cancer patients, rheumatoid arthritis patients. My wife and her extended family has severe and chronic Crohn's disease. And so these are all illnesses that I've seen cannabis directly touch and benefit in a very positive way. So it made me a believer firsthand many years ago. And I just took that and I always held on to that. And it's something that I truly, at the end of the day, I believe in it. You know, I believe that that it has a lot of value and a lot of benefits. So absolutely, I was thankful to participate as a caregiver for approximately 10 years before opening the retail storefront there.
Yeah. Patty, this isn't true across the board, but sometimes you run into a generational divide about how people feel about cannabis. There are younger members of my family, I know, that just sort of they've grown up with the idea that it was gradually becoming legalized, and they don't tend to get hung up about it. But older members of my family, it's just not something that they would necessarily think of trying. Have you had conversations with people your own age about, you know, where this the evolution of cannabis as something that's increasingly a part of our lives?
That's a big subject, and there is a big divide. Generationally, I grew up not thinking about it the way my son thinks about it. And I have come around to embrace it more. But I have tried having those conversations with family members that are my generation and older. And that divide is very much there still, to the point where sometimes it's hard to try to win somebody over to your way of thinking, that sometimes you just have to accept those divisions and those differences.
You know, this is really a transformative time, but as you say, like, some of us are sort of in process with it at the same time. Would you say that you've seen changes in Casey over the time that he's been involved with the business? And like, he had this background in corporate banking and then, you know, started this business himself. Have you observed anything of that's changed in him in this period?
I think that Casey has always had I'm biased, I'm his mom, but I believe that he's always had a sweet nature about him ever since he was a child. And I don't want to downplay his experience in corporate America, but I saw him go through a lot of stress and he went through a lot of growth. There was a lot of good things that were happening, but I also saw how terribly unhappy he was in that arena. And being in the arena that he's in now, it's like, to me, it's like watching a bird take flight, you know, spreading their wings and, you know, just really enjoying life and what life has to offer and the growth potential that he has. It's neat to watch that.
If folks are wondering about the birds, we should acknowledge that you're coming to us from home, as a lot of our guests do. I feel like the birds came in right on cue there, Patty, as you were making that analogy. We're talking today with Patty Cornoli and Casey Cornoli, a mother and son. And Casey's the owner of Farmhouse Wellness, a medical and recreational marijuana dispensary in Grand Rapids. And Patty works as part of the business, too. Patty, was there anything in particular that kind of brought you around on this as a possibility, as a possibility for Casey in terms of professional stuff, but also something that you would want to get on board with?
Well, I have to say that in the beginning, I was quite under duress when he was 14 and 15. I was very protective and worried about the direction that he seemed to be enthralled in. And it's taken me a while. It's really has taken me a while. I mean, he had to get an education. He had to go corporate. He had to work all that that whole experience for me to say, okay, you earned your stripes, and you are accepted in society. And then he wants to do this. And what was it that turned me around? And I feel a little bit emotional about it, so forgive me. When you have a patient that is a caregiver, you know, Casey's a caregiver to that patient, and that patient is struggling with stage 4 cancer, and they have gone through all the medical routes that they are advised to go through, and they seek the professionals that they're supposed to seek, and they end up being having addictions to opioids or whatever, and then being cut off from that source of help to manage pain, to manage, you know, all the things that a person goes through when it comes to cancer. I was just appalled to hear that story. And then they're being left to find routes for their own care. And they then seek medical marijuana. And it's not just an experience like that. It's like people that come curbside at the dispensary. I mean, I had one lady that came. She had like an $800 order. And I was like, wow, this is just that's a lot of pot. But what she was saying is, you guys are our pharmacy. I have a child that's epileptic, and this is helping her epilepsy. And she's struggling with sleep. And it, you know, so when you experience those kinds of experiences, it's just like, who am I to judge? Who am I to say, no, that's not okay for you? It has completely changed my whole attitude.
Yeah. Casey, your mom, being your mom, is being a bit circumspect about some of your past with cannabis. You've shared with us that you were caught up with the law a few times. Could you tell us a little bit about how that happened and maybe how those things affected the path of your career?
It's been just a long and windy journey for me, starting from my early adolescence when I was initially drawn to the cannabis plant. And these were times where cannabis was still heavily under prohibition and over policing. And unfortunately, you could say I was maybe just a little bit ahead of the curve, or I guess if you look at it like that, that's a positive thing. But I was just maybe a little bit ahead of the time on the laws. And yes, I did have some run-ins with law enforcement, multiple encounters where I was arrested and charged. And I do have cannabis convictions on my record. And unfortunately, those things stay with me today. But it is part of who I am. It's part of my journey. It did influence the route that I went after high school. You know, I had attempted to get into the armed services and was declined. I did end up getting into college and finishing a college degree. But I had after that had gone through what I felt was a pretty decent amount of labor market discrimination, labor market employment counseling, and then ultimately the process of applying with the state of Michigan and the city of Grand Rapids to become a cannabis operator was also impacted by that history that I had with the plant. So it was at the time something when I was crying in my milk, nothing that I would think would ever good become of it. But now it's strange to see that this in a roundabout way has actually allowed Farmhouse Wellness and myself to be the only social equity applicant in the city of Grand Rapids. And it hinges on some of that history. You know, do you have cannabis related convictions on your record? And were you overly affected by the war on drugs? And I was one of those people.
Could you talk a little bit more about the social equity program process and what it's meant for you and the business?
Absolutely. The social equity program is, I think at its roots, is designed to encourage and participate people in the cannabis industry who otherwise wouldn't have had so much of an opportunity to enter that marketplace. So when the state came and they said, here is what constitutes a social equity applicant, I was absolutely enthralled. I jumped for joy on the retail showroom floor when I saw what allowed us to qualify for that designation. And the benefit of it is that the state and the city of Grand Rapids do give us certain financial breaks. As you know, that there's a lot of regulation and taxes and fees to being a cannabis operator. So the state said, okay, we get it. You're a smaller operator. We're going to give you some breaks and try to help you on your way. So that's very helpful. But for me, I felt a strong calling to give that money back and to reinvest that money into the community that has supported us, being the lower west side of Grand Rapids and the West Wealthy Corridor, the John Ball area neighborhood, and the city of Grand Rapids. So we have a pretty robust social equity plan, little baby steps that we're making, but we're so, so thankful and proud to be the only social equity applicant in the city of Grand Rapids. And we feel, you know, a strong calling to give that money back and to reinvest it for the greater benefit of the community. So, and really looking forward to that program in the future.
Patty, with all of this in mind, the fact that Casey would have a chance to open a cannabis business, what would you say that's meant, that what you've seen that's mean to him, and also what it's meant to you to see him find this place in his life?
I feel for the most part, I've been always very proud of Casey and his drive and his interest. But when he came to me, or when he was talking with us as a family about the potential of pursuing this, I thought, well, you know, that's something that you know a lot about. And that pretty much was all that there was in the beginning, is that's an interest and that's a possibility. But to see it come to fruition, I personally don't feel like we can take all that credit. I sometimes believe, I do believe, that some things are just divine. The doors open for a reason, and I feel like in this case, the doors opened for Casey to pursue this business, and it's just been really neat watching him go through the struggles, the changes, the growth, the experience, and it's just neat watching him mature and move forward in an area that he's so excited about.
My guests today have been Patty Cornoli and her son, Casey Cornoli. They are part of the family ownership team in Farmhouse Wellness, a cannabis business in Grand Rapids, coming to us from Patty's home, as you can hear. Patty, happy Mother's Day.
Thank you very much.
And Casey, thank you also. We really appreciate you telling us a little bit more about the business.
Thank you so much for having us. I really appreciate the interest in our story.
And that's Stateside for today. I'm April Baer. Thank you so much for listening. We hope you have a great weekend. See you next time.